This is the word of the Lord. It's a great passage that I've been given to speak on this morning, and so we're going to be looking at that passage. So do keep your fingers at that particular page so you can follow as we make our way through this particular text. As space exploration progresses, and they're sending satellites into space with these massive telescopes, very powerful, that can see further and further and further afield. And as that happens, as that progresses, there's a growing hope that we'll be able to find a planet like ours that'll sustain life. So let me read to you from a blog that I found on the web. It says this: pack your bags, everyone. NASA announced today it has discovered 7 new Earth-sized planets, at least 3 of which could potentially support life, and they are relatively close by. All of the planets orbit TRAPPIST-1, an ultra-cool dwarf star roughly the size of Jupiter. The system is close to Earth, relatively speaking, about 100,000 years away, in fact. TRAPPIST is located in the Aquarius constellation, less than 40 light-years from us. That's a long way away. But anyway, let's assume, just for the sake of argument this morning, that there is a particular planet circulating around TRAPPIST, and that it does support life, that there are beings on this particular planet. Let's just assume that for the sake of argument. Let's call them trapezoids. So there are these trapezoids, and they live on this planet, one of the planets revolving around TRAPPIST. And I want you to just think a little bit about this for a moment. What would these trapezoids be like? Do they look like us? Do they have sort of our resemblance? Do they have 2 eyes and 2 arms and 2 legs? Well, what do you think? Do they have hair or do they have scales? Can they communicate? Do they have an advanced form of communication, or do they just grunt like cavemen? What do they eat? What do they like? How do they live? And the answer to questions like that is, of course, well, we just don't know. Any answer we give will be pure speculation. It will be a wild guess. But imagine for a moment that a spaceship suddenly landed somewhere in our world, and blow me down if out of the door of the spacecraft suddenly stepped down a trapezoid. And in fact, he had 3 eyes and 4 legs. He didn't have hair or scales, he just had a smooth skin. Somebody visited our world from this world out there. Only then would we have any confidence in knowing what he looked like, what these trapezoids did, what they were like. And what I wanted you to recognize is that it is no different with us as we speculate about some of those big questions in life, like why are we here? And what's this all about? And is there more to our existence than what we have just here and now? And is there life after death? And is there a God? And what is that God like? The different religions offer their suggestions, of course. We think that when we die, we come back like a cat or a dog. We think that when you die, that's it. It's the end. There's nothing more. We think that God is like a woman with many breasts. We think that if you give your life for the cause, you'll have 10 virgins waiting for you in heaven, and so on. And what all these different suggestions have in common is that they speak out of their ignorance. It's pure speculation. It's the sorts of things that they've dreamed up, that they have imagined. And you can't help but ask the question, wouldn't it be wonderful if somebody came from that other world and visited our world and set the record straight? And the answer that John gives in this particular passage is that that is exactly what has happened. Someone has come from that other world, and he has made God known. verse 18. No one has ever seen God, but the one and only Son, who is himself God and is with the Father, he has made him known. Now, when John says that no one has seen God, I think he's talking here about more than just catching a glimpse of God as God passes by, as happened with Moses. I think he's talking about more than just an impression of the glory of God, as happened with Isaiah when he entered the temple and saw the train of God that filled the temple. I think what John is talking about here is that otherness of God. The fact that God is so much above us and beyond us that he is impossible to discover and to find out. I don't know if you remember, but it was a while back, but there was one of those Russian cosmonauts who took a spaceship, went with a spaceship into orbit around the moon, and he came back saying, "We did not see God, so we've proved that God does not exist." God is beyond us. He is past finding out. If he does not reveal himself to us, there is very little that we can know about him, apart, of course, from what we see in the creation. So when John says no one has ever seen God, I think what he means is seeing him with understanding, seeing him with comprehension, a knowing sort of seeing. William Taylor speaks of this as our human condition. If God does not reveal himself, we are in the dark as to his true nature and character. All of these things are hidden from us. And Don Carson, in his commentary on John's Gospel, he offers two more reasons why God is beyond finding out, why it is not possible for us to know him as we are apart from Christ. And the first reason that Carson gives is because God is spirit. And the second reason is because our sinfulness excludes us from knowing God. It creates something of a barrier, something of an obstacle through which we cannot see. And what Carson explains is that Jesus overcame both of those obstacles, first of all, by showing us what God is like in himself. The Word became flesh. We'll look at that in a moment. When Philip was with Jesus and one of his disciples was talking with Jesus, he said to Jesus on one occasion, he said, "Lord, show us the Father." And Jesus replied, "Have you known me for so long, Philip, and you do not know yet? He who has seen me has seen the Father." So Jesus makes the invisible God visible in himself. Then secondly, explains Carson, Jesus makes it possible for sinful people like you and me to see God by dealing with our sin. I don't know if you've ever, I'm sure you have, looked in the mirror and it's all fogged up, it's misty with steam and so on, and you can't see anything really. But when you take the cloth and you clean away the mist and the steam, suddenly everything is clear. Suddenly you can see things as they are. And that's exactly what Jesus does through his sacrificial death on the cross for us. He removes the barrier of our sinfulness so that we can now see God clearly. Jesus has made God known. And this idea that Jesus has made God known is something that recurs in our passage. You can see it in various places. So, for example, in verse 1, "In the beginning was the Word." Now, in referring to Jesus as the Word, the Logos, what John is doing is he's making connections with a number of different strands of understandings in the culture that he, or in the readers that he's speaking to. So, for example, among the Greeks believed that the Logos was like the creating principle of the universe. And for the Jews, the Logos was the Word through which the world came into being. God spoke, and it was. And so there are these connections that are being made and many more. But one of the things we can surely say is that the Word speaks of God's self-revelation. It's God's message. Through the Word, God is speaking to us about himself. The idea of Jesus making God known is one of the themes. Through the Word, he makes himself known. But not only is he the Word, but he's also the light, verse 4. He was the light of man. Verse 5, he was the light that shines in the darkness. So what does the light do? The light reveals. The light makes known, makes clear what is maybe hidden. Under our house, we have this space, dark, dank, beneath the building is one of those old Queenslanders, and there are these posts that hold up the house. And I've used this space to store my stuff and Mitchell's and Jess's stuff and also our tools. And it's pretty difficult to make your way around there in the dark, particularly late at night. It is something of a rabbit warren, and it is something of an arduous task to make your way through there. You've always got to be careful that you don't trip over some piece of furniture, that you don't step on the rake, that you don't tread on the chainsaw or knock over my precious drill. And worse still, you never know if suddenly a spider is going to fall on your head until you turn the light on. And then suddenly everything is plain, everything is clear. The darkness at that moment disappears. And that's what Jesus has done through his coming, through his dealing with our sinfulness. He has made it possible for us to see clearly. The darkness is banished. All these other religious teachings, mere guesswork. But with Jesus, certainty. God has made him known. Sorry, he has made God known. But the question, I suppose, is how is Jesus any different from all these other prophets and spiritual gurus who lay claim to speaking on God's behalf, who offer their own particular view of spirituality, their own particular brand of enlightenment? Well, they speak from ignorance, whereas Jesus speaks from what he knows, because he has come from that other world. That's another theme that you find recurring through this particular passage. Look at verse 1 again. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And what John is suggesting here is that Jesus' life did not just begin with his birth, but that it preceded his birth. As far back as you can go, in fact, as right to the beginning, in fact, even beyond, he was with God in the beginning. Later on in John's Gospel, Jesus is engaged in this controversy, this argument with the Pharisees. They were always trying to trip him up. And in amidst the argument, Jesus suddenly throws in the statement where he says this. He says, Abraham rejoiced at the thought of seeing my day. He saw it and was glad. Hang on, they objected. Are you not just somewhere between less than 50 years old and you've seen Abraham? How's that possible? And Jesus replies coolly, before Abraham was Yahweh. Before Abraham was, I am. So Jesus is well qualified to speak about heavenly things because he's come from there. Heaven is his home. That's where he's come from. But he wants his readers to understand more than that Jesus was just God's companion. John wants his readers to understand that Jesus was not only God's with God, by God's side, but that he in fact was God. You can see that again in verse 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And we find the same idea repeated in verse 18. No one has ever seen God, but God the one and only. In another translation, who is at the Father's side, he has made him known. And that is why Jesus is uniquely qualified to teach us about what God is like, to reveal God to us, to make God known, because he was not only from God, but because he was God. And it is this God, this Word from eternity, it is this God, this one through whom the whole universe was made, it is this God who takes on flesh. You can see that in verse 14. The Word became flesh and made His dwelling among us. Now, I want you to stop. I don't want you just to nod in assent to these words as if it's nothing out of the ordinary. It's staggering. On the one hand, and I picked up this idea, and it's a powerful idea from Andy Satch. On the one hand, you have Jesus spoken of in these cosmic terms. He's the Eternal One. He's the one who, through whom nothing was made that has been made. In Him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. There is something truly cosmic about this Christ that John is describing. And then with the next breath he says, and the Word became flesh. And it's really the fusion of those two things that is mind-blowing. The eternal with the everyday. The divine with the human. The cosmic with the ordinary. He came to live with us, says John. We saw it with our own eyes. We handled Him. We touched Him. We spoke with Him. We witnessed it for ourselves. You know those orderlies that they have in the hospitals pushing beds around from one ward to another or pushing wheelchairs and so on? Very ordinary people. Imagine for a moment if somebody took you aside and said, do you see Charlie over there? He's God. He's God. Come to live with us. Everything that is owes its existence to Charlie. He's responsible for creation itself. He's the Eternal One. He's the Divine One. He is God come down. And what John is saying is something very similar to that. This ordinary person, so down to earth, he could be the guy down the street. This is God become flesh. He is God dwelling with us. And in fact, when Jesus graced our world, you need to recognize this, most people failed to acknowledge His presence. They didn't know that He was there. It would be a little bit like if William and Kate suddenly decided to visit Brisbane. And I don't know, but William would have had to wear something to cover his bald head. And Kate might have had dark glasses or whatever. And they sit down over there at Three Girls Skipping and they have a cup of coffee. Most of us would actually not even know it was them unless somebody told us. We would not realize that royalty was in our presence. And for most people at the time of Jesus, when Jesus graced our world, for most people it was a case of they didn't realize that God was amongst them. The Word became flesh and made His dwelling with us. And yet most people did not recognize Him. The tragedy, though, in the story is that not only did most people not recognize Him, but the very people for whom He came, the Jews, those who had been shepherded by God through the centuries, those who God had been speaking to in prophecy and in different ways about the coming of the Messiah. Those were the very people who didn't just not acknowledge Him, but they rejected Him. They actively closed their hearts against Him. It would be a little bit like if somebody came to your front door and you slammed the door in their face. That's what happened. That's the picture that's been painted here. They did not receive Him, they rejected Him. And then John adds, yet to all who did receive Him, this Word that had become flesh, to all that did receive Him, to those who believed in His name, to them He gave the right, the authority to become children of God. Notice the absolute certainty in this. No ifs, no maybes. If you put your trust in Him, you can have absolute assurance, absolute confidence, absolute certainty that God will adopt you into His family, that He will make you His child, His son, or His daughter. Yet to all who did receive Him, to those who believed in His name, to them He gave the right, the authority to become children of God. Amongst all the doubts and the uncertainties that are spoken around us, am I good enough? Will He accept me? Have I tried it hard enough? Have I whacked enough chickens? Have I slaughtered enough goats? Have I done enough pilgrimages? Have I said enough rosaries? Amongst all of the doubts and the uncertainties, how wonderful to have that assurance, that confidence, that through trusting in Jesus, I have become a child of God. No more doubts for us, no more uncertainty. This is something that we can have absolute confidence in. And Christmas, well, it's where it all began. It's where the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. There's a lovely little clip from Charlie Brown that I'd love to share with you in closing.
You've been dumb before, Charlie Brown, but this time you really did it.